good foundations on which happy family life can be lived and enjoyed. We're reading 1 Corinthians from verse 25 here, and you'll see that basically what we've had up until now is that the apostle has been sort of dealing with a very very unhelpful attitude in the minds, particularly I think of a certain group of men in the church, and we see it from verse 12 of chapter 6, where they basically sort of have this kind of I can do what I like attitude. And then in chapter 7, it's the knock-on effect of that into personal relationships and marriage relationships in particular. And as we've been going through it, we did one message particularly dealing with marriage, and then we got down to the issues of this kind of restlessness in their hearts. That seems to be the problem, that they're just so unhappy. Is it verse 17? With the assignments, with the calls that Christ has given them. It's as if they want to sort of write their own story rather than be the sheep of his pasture, to do it his way. And so he's been dealing with this issue of a lack of peace and contentment, just about living the life that Christ has given you to live, and seeing that as your calling, as your mission. And he's calling them to the repentance. Now, in this section that we're reading from verse 25, he starts to turn his attention to the single people of the church. Now, remember that this book is written to this particular church in this particular situation. That's important to remember. And as he brings up the subject in verse 25 there, of the virgins in the church, that very word conjures up for us a picture of innocence, doesn't it? Of people untouched by the world, youth. And here are these people that need to be considered in the life of the church. There they are in the church at a time when the church is going through a crisis. So imagine the young people of a church, the young girls of the church, and at a time when the relationships of the adults, the people who are their examples, the people who they're learning the lessons of life from, seem so utterly chaotic that they are beginning to picture their futures. That's what happens, isn't it? Young people look at their futures as they see the adults around them, and they evaluate their futures as they look at the lives of the people around them. And in the circumstances of the church at that time, what they see around them is that the marriages around them seem to be faithless unions. People who, on paper, they're married, and formally speaking, they're married, but we live under the same roof and all the rest of it. But in practice, there is no faithfulness, there's no mutual devotion or shared heart and mind. There's a lot of hurt and a lot of heartache in those families at that particular time. And it seems to be the symptom of the attitudes, the prevailing attitudes of the society around. And that's the problem with the church at Corinth. It's hard to tell the difference between them and everybody else. Their lifestyles seem to be just really a mirror, but in the church, of what's going on outside. That marriage is not the image of Christ and his church. The faithfulness of Christ to his people, but a kind of political union between two families that's mutually convenient and encouraging and pleasing for a season, probably, to the two individuals who've got together and all the rest of it. But ultimately, it seems that these marriages, both outside in Corinth and in the church, are quite degrading to the individuals concerned. People end up divorced, people end up brokenhearted, and there are young people. We mentioned that last time when we were talking about divorce. We remembered about how many divorces in this country take place, and there are children still in the home. And young people are growing up, and they're innocent, relatively innocent. Innocent is not sinless. You know, there's a difference between sinlessness and innocence, isn't there? They're relatively innocent, and they're growing up with all this stuff going on all around them. And even marriage doesn't seem to be a kind of a bastion and a fortress and a safe place. It just seems to be an extension, as much affected by the corruption that's in the world as everything else they see all around them. And the city, imagine you were growing up as a kid. You were growing up in Corinth. And, you know, there are kind of, it's open immorality, and there's no real premium placed on fidelity in marriage and or in personal relationships or dealings. Do we have, I mean, the sad thing is we don't actually have to cast our minds back 2,000 years to some foreign city and imagine such a situation coming. Think of our children. Think about what they're growing up in. Think about some of us have grown up in. And here they are, relatively innocent of so much. They've yet to experience for themselves the things that we're actually working out and living out. And around them, there's so many calls on them. There's so many temptations, so many invitations, so many encouragements to not hope and just dive in. You know, sadly, there's too many churches where, you know, it looks something like this. You bring kids to church, and they come to church, and they go to Sunday school, and, blah, 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 and then they kind of hit that age where they've got a bit of independence, and they can say what they're going to do for themselves, and then they go. And you just hope and pray that somehow something's been settled in their lives, because you have no command or control or voice, or they're gone. And you just hope they might come back, and sometimes they don't come back till they're 60. They've already done it, and they've already been, you've tried it out for themselves and tried to do it the world's way, because they've bought into it. So I don't think the situation in Corinth is that different. I don't think the situation in Corinth is that different. And he wants them to think about this. He wants particularly the weight and the burden of this passage leading forward has been on the attitude of the men of the church. And that's really who he's writing to, principally. I'm not saying he's not talking to the women of the church or anybody else, but he has a particular desire to get a hold of the hearts and the mind of the men of the church. And my friend Jared, I think some of you have met, went out to the Czech Republic before he went to India, where he did do an orphanage project in India now. But he went out to the Czech Republic just after the Iron Curtain came down, and he stood out on the street corners and they started preaching Christ. They got a little loud hailer thing, and people came in their droves. They hadn't heard about Christianity for 50 years in these communist countries. He ended up involved in pastoring a number of churches. He was the piano player, right, for the team that went in there. So he was like doing your job, Rachel, you know, playing the piano. But there was just so many people asking questions, and there was such massive ignorance that he ended up being a pastor, because there was just simply not enough people who could do the work. And he was the best man in town. He was just the piano player, but he knew more about Jesus than they did. But the thing he found was this: people who was faithful in the coming to do the Sunday school, who was faithful to turn up to service, who was faithful to come out and pray, who was faithful to serve, who was faithful to live for Christ and speak about him, who was faithful to tell their friends, who was faithful to bring people along to church. You know who it was? The women. And the men, they just kind of had this very passive backseat role. He basically analysed that in communism, you know, if a man took any initiative, they showed any entrepreneurial flair or put their head above the parapet or showed an opinion or gave some leadership, that marked them out as a bit of a troublemaker. And they learned over those 50 years. You just keep your head down, you go to work in the morning, you do your job, you drink a pint of vodka, and you hope to make it home in one piece and not fall asleep in a snowdrift. And people do, and they die. Miserable, right? And they had to preach the word and preach the word and preach the word, and they saw a change in the life of the men. They began to see their place, see their value, see their role, rise up and give some leadership and take responsibility. And what a precious thing that was. And here, when he talks about the virgins there, it's quite interesting. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Greek grammar, but there's a tense called the genitive, which is basically the possessive. So it's kind of Think about your girls. Think about your girls. That's a kind of paraphrase of it, but I think it gives the sense of it. Think about your girls. Think about them growing up. What's going to become of them? What's their futures? The flowers growing in our garden. What's going to become of them? In their time, and seems all the way through time, there seems to be a great cult surrounding the chastity of girls. I don't know if you've kind of picked up on that. I'm sure you have, and I know it's all to do with the anxieties that people have had in former times about the legal question of inheritance. How do I know that I can pass on my farm to my son? Because by preserving the chastity of my daughters, I could do that. And what's extraordinary is that there's such a lack of moral equivalence. Let me give you an example. Those of you, I'm sure you all see The Godfather. You watch lots of mafia films and boss gangland movies, don't you? I'm sure you do. No? I'm joking. I doubt you do. But if you did, you might know. You might know. It goes something like this. This guy, he's like basically like Satan incarnate. He just blows people away all the time and ruins people's life for a living. But touch my daughter, and I'll make a concrete coffin for you, and you'll end up at the bottom of the Hudson River, right? It is the cardinal sin. You can do anything, right? And he does anything he wants, but touch my daughter, right? There is no moral equivalence there. He's not prepared to live a faithful life, to be faithful, to keep himself, to live holy, and yet expects absolutely, absolutely that she should. It's very hard, isn't it? Very, very hard to accept when you say, be faithful, from somebody who evidently is so faithless. What is the great, if we had a creedal statement for the Church of the Hypocrites, it would be, do as I say, not do as I do. We all know it. And that's the kind of atmosphere that these kids are growing up in, where there's no moral equivalence. Very hard, isn't it, when you're teaching kids to honour your mother and father. I mean, the very least that one could do if we're going to preach a message on honour your mother and father is try, by the grace of God, to live honourably. To make honouring us a delight and a joy. But here in this church, it's absolutely out of control. Absolutely out of control. So, Paul is speaking to them. Think about the moral dilemmas these people are facing. Think about their futures. Think about somebody else for a minute. And he talks of a crisis, doesn't he, in verse 26. I don't know if you can see it there. He talks about a crisis taking place. And there's a lot of ink spilled about this crisis. I think the NIV, I kind of like the NIV. But it has its moments where I think it kind of gets into interpreting things. It gets a little bit dramatic. They're quite dramatic sometimes. I think we could easily translate that as the present needs. The present needs. The needs of the hour. You know, when you open the fridge, there's no milk. The same, the Greek word there, that's, you could translate it as like, oh, we need milk. Something we've got to do right now. I'm not trying to say that is something as small as the need of milk. But it is saying, these crisis does suggest, pushes people's minds out in a certain sort of way. And people have come back with, well, because of the present persecutions that are breaking out of the church. But we know about this church, they weren't being persecuted. I mean, they might be kind of persecuted in the way we're being persecuted. I should think when you become a Christian, your likelihood of becoming socially elevated and making your way up the social echelons is probably somewhat hindered, I'd have thought. You might even go on a slightly downward track in terms of social mobility, if you become a Christian. But, you know, in terms of persecution, that might be a bit strong. I don't think the Corinthians would have been persecuted. In fact, I know they weren't. There's nothing in the book about their persecutions. Oh, maybe there's a war about to break out or a famine. No, actually, Corinth was a very secure, prosperous city in a relatively central place. It was very useful and there wasn't a lot of problems. Rather like today, you know, life goes on. It's all right. Everything's fine. There's bread on the table. So what is this Christ? What are the present needs? Is it because Jesus is coming back? I mean, he certainly talks about that in a minute. I think it's the fact that they, even though they are Christians, they have morally collapsed. They are morally collapsing. and these kids are growing up in an atmosphere where they can hardly tell the difference between the Christian lifestyle as they see it witnessed in the church and the attitudes of the world as they witness it outside. What are we teaching? What are we saying? You can't tell me that divorce and so on and so forth, or marital breakdown and immorality, has no psychological effect on kids. I mean, I know it's important the way all these things are handled, and sometimes bad things happen. But some things, the general downgrading of marriage and all these sort of things, it's a spiritual cancer. And imagine growing up when you're a prospect. What are you going to do? I'm going to get married one day. You've got to get married one day. You're going to have a nice dress one day. I'm going to pack you up like a Christmas present, and you're going to be delivered one day. And then when they're bored of you, and Christmas is over, you'll be just signed over for life. Is that the kind of thing we want to pack our daughters off to? Is that kind of the future we want? And, you know, all the immorality around would present, in those kind of terms, quite an attractive option. Quite an attractive option. Demoralization. You know, that's one of the things. I hope everybody here, I know they're not always straightforward, but broadly speaking, as a basic thing, kids are wonderful. Aren't they? Right? They're remarkable. They're remarkable people. Childhood is such an extraordinary thing, isn't it? They're so quick. They're learning. They learn so fast. They don't miss anything, do they? It's bright as buttons. So adaptable, and quick and perceptive and all those sort of things. Remarkable. And we talk to them and we teach them. And that Sunday schools and all those sort of things, we give lessons and so on and so forth. And we talk to kids and we talk to them at home. But we know that whatever we say, they are watching what we do. Our lives, how we exemplify things, that is what leaves the lasting. I mean, I'm not saying they don't forget our words. I'm not saying our words have no value, please. I'm not saying that. But if unsubstantiated by a real life, they're left back to square one, having to work it all out for themselves. So, children need Christ, don't they? They don't need to be entertained. I'm not suggesting that's what we're doing here, by the way. But they just generally is a statement about churches. They don't need to be entertained for 40 minutes while we do the God bit and the sermon and then re-release. They need Christ, don't they? They need to be pastored. They need to be loved. They need to be taught. They need a personal relationship so that the fluctuations, perhaps even of the adults around them, whether Christians or otherwise, they can be insulated against some of those transformations, those changes. They need Christ, don't they? They need a personal relationship. But they also, please God, grant them good and godly examples. Parents who stand for Christ and love the Lord. And that's why here, I think, in verse 26, Paul passes his judgment. Because up until now, at the beginning, he says, you know, I'm not going to tell you what to do here. I'm not giving you any commandments. I'm offering you, and this is really, really important, isn't it? Because just talking about marriage, I wonder how many of us here, when we were getting married, when we were getting committed to marriage, had somebody who was a godly pillar of a man, put an arm on our shoulder and talk to us before we entered into what, as we hear at the end of this passage, a woman is bound to her husband, verse 39, as long as he lives. A lifelong commitment. How many people really got godly advice and counsel from a trustworthy person on as they entered in onto the commitment of marriage? Do you think it might be important that we do these things soberly, knowing the facts? I'm not saying we have to know everything. I mean, you know, you do kind of work some stuff out. hadn't it? And he's offering them his judgment, isn't he? And he passes this judgment in verse 26. And in light of the situation that's facing them in the church, and the lack of moral example from the fathers and from the sons, from the brothers and so on and so forth, he offers them this judgment. This may not be the best time to get married. There may be things that we need to straighten out first, effectively. Because this is it. This is the moral disparity, isn't it? Because there is so much emphasis on getting the girls to keep themselves and to be faithful and all the rest of it. How much emphasis is there on getting the boys to do the same? It's different for boys. Is it? Is it different for boys? Because in the end, he's not discouraging people from getting married. That's not the purpose. But shouldn't a girl have a reasonable expectation that the person she's going to marry and spend the rest of her life with is going to love her and be faithful to her? I'm not saying it won't be difficult or there won't be things to overcome, but basically that is the principle, that is the lesson, that is the conviction and the belief held in that young man's heart. And that he's going to seek to do that, and he knows what's expected of him, and live it out. And that was not happening in this church at that time. So, you know, they talk about headship, men being the head. Whether we accept our responsibilities or even quit our responsibilities well or not, we are still the head. What we do, what we don't do, has a consequence on the people around us, whether we like it or not. It's inescapable. And actually, probably sometimes I think, you know, it's like the tough... Do you all keep to-do lists? Some of you have to-do lists sometimes? Used to. The to-do lists have this kind of shape to them, don't they? There's the things you want to do. They're easy and quick to do. Quick wins. And then there's usually one or two on there that are like staring at you going... And you kind of can put them off till tomorrow and all the rest of it. Sometimes just doing it God's way. Doing it God's way. Submitting to His will. And saying, yes, Lord, here I am. That's the hardest thing to do. But when you do it, it is the most important thing to be done. It's not just marriage. Faithfulness. Men being faithful in marriage is just one very, very important aspect, isn't it? Modelling it to their kids and so on and so forth. But how a consequence it is to every area of our life and to all of us, to men, to women, to all of us, to be faithful, to be found faithful. Why? You know, Christ was single, wasn't he? Christ was single. Was Christ faithful? Did he keep himself? He was. And each of us, we've got to do that, haven't we? Because we are trying, by God's grace, to speak of Christ through our words and through our lives. To be like Him. To be like Him. And in verse 27, there's always somebody, isn't there, who puts up their hand and goes, "Excuse me, sir, I have a question. I'm already engaged." Now, some of you will have the new international version, modern versions, which says, "Are you pledged to be married?" Some of you have the ESV, "Are you pledged to be married?" Some of you have the King James, "Are you betrothed or pledged to be married?" And some of you, well, all of us, because most of us who've got this blue Bible, will have the old 1984 NIV, which says, "Are you married?" And there's a reason why the NIV stands out from all the others, because it's wrong. To cut a long story short. But they've corrected it in the new versions. They've mistranslated. It's about a pledge. So the question here is, I've already made a commitment. I've already asked Auntie Madge to make the sandwiches. I've already booked the hall. She's got her dress. We bought the ring. Are you trying to tell me that I should break it all off in the light of everything that you're saying? Is it we're going to break off the commitment? He's been very particular, isn't he, at the beginning. He says, "I'm not giving you a commandment. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm not telling you what to do, but I am offering you some very, very valuable advice. take it on board. Take it into your marriage. If you're getting married, take this into your marriage. And if you're not already engaged and getting ready to get married, don't get in a hurry about it. Don't go seeking it. Seek to master being single. Master that. Master that first. Christ was single, wasn't he? It's not a sin to get married, verse 28. It's a wonderful thing. Right? Getting married is a wonderful thing. But it's not a command. It's not a command. And he's been offered good advice. Because marriage is tough. And I'm telling you, if you cook up the recipe of marriage, you know, some people like adding chili, don't they? They put loads and loads of chili on it. And you can get that wrong. You start putting faithlessness, unfaithfulness in the pot, it becomes pretty much inedible. It can become like hell on earth. You've got to know what you're getting involved with. You've got to enter these things into it soberly. And this guys can do what they want attitude is not of God and it's got to go home. And people want to be the head of the home and the priest in their own living room and all the rest of it. But that does mean you first and foremostly have to have some spiritual maturity about you then. To carry that office. So he says it's not a sin to get married. What's the sin that he's trying to identify here? What would you say the sin he's trying to identify? Really focusing in on people who make commitments with no real intention to follow them through, or no real wherewithal or capacity to do what they say they're going to do, and never actually sitting down and facing Christ and looking at him and looking at who he is and what he calls us to do, and just going ahead anyway. And leaving a wake of pain and hurt behind. Got to consider Jesus, haven't you? Consider Jesus. He did it. Now here, from this bit onwards, we have a bit of an aside. Verse 29. What I mean, brothers, he kind of takes them aside for a moment. You're right. Continues all the way down to verse 29 to 35, this bit of an aside. And I'm not sure, maybe an aside is not the right word, maybe a bit of an upward glance. You know, sometimes the thing about relationships and the thing about possessions and our houses and our Christmases and our homes and who's coming and the dinner and what we're going to get everybody and our relationships and who and so said to what's the so and so and do you know what happened and you know I can't believe he did that and all the rest of it is like it can become like an episode of Made in Chelsea, which I hope nobody here is taking too seriously. But if you even know what that is, basically it's just people obsessing about their relationships and obsessing about their possessions and their status and all the rest of it, and it's rolled out as entertainment and it's entirely hypnotic and mesmerizing and engrossing and all the rest of it, and then you realize it is spiritually absolutely devoid of all life. It's toxic waste. And that's the point that he brings up here, taking them aside for a moment. Let me just take you aside. You know, time is short, people. Life canters by. Christ is coming. He is. It's good to remember, isn't it? Even just talking about it openly, publicly, reminds us. And even as, I mean, they all died, okay? They didn't see the return of Jesus. Their houses, their marriages, their wedding rings. The wedding rings don't even exist anymore. It's all a long, long time ago. And generation after generation have done that. Our generation may pass without seeing Christ. I'm not saying it will, but I'm saying it may. But we will see him either way. And so soon. Just by the law of logic, you know that when you're a little kid, you know, a month seems like, you know, you measure life in sleeps. You know, three more sleeps? You're innocent, aren't you? You can't believe it. Now you get a diary and you're sort of putting things in for the middle of next year or something like that. It's just like, how did I get in my life? I can't believe it's Sunday again, and it's Sunday again. What's happened to my life? I tell you, before you know it, we're going to see him. So just let's not get so bogged down and engrossed and invested into all of this. Hold it lightly. Treasure it by all means. But let's remember there are more important things. And Christmas is the classic time for all of this, isn't it? It can be the flesh fest. It doesn't have to be. And I trust for all of you, it won't be. But it can be. It can be. And according to verse 31, the world is going to end. We're not here forever. It's not going to just go on and on forever. And we lose it all. And as he goes into verse 30 there, he reminds you about the people who mourn. And you only have to ask the widows or ask the divorcees or ask the people who've lost everything and chucked out of their home and all the others. And they'll tell you, if you get a quiet moment, that if you lose sight of your own personal walk with Christ in the midst of all these things, when these happens to you, you are at sea. We need Christ. Kids on their own need Christ. And he goes on into verse 28 and verse 29, dealing with people who are married. You remember, yes, you're married. But you are still individuals. You may be one flesh, but you're not one soul. You have to keep your own personal walk with Christ going through it all. That's what counts. Our walk with the Lord. And in a sense, that is really the mastering of singleness. Mastering of singleness, whether you are single or will remain single, or are now single, or you're in a marriage, there's a singleness that has to be mastered and maintained through it all. And if you don't have a proper view of marriage, if we don't have a proper view of singleness, we will not have a proper view of marriage, will we? The whole idea of having to keep yourself and to be pure. That's got to be there. Christ did it. And when you get people who live like that, a whole group of individuals who live like that, self-controlled, well-adjusted individuals, that's going to be a great church or a great society, isn't it? And yeah, we may enter into our partnerships, but we all remain morally accountable whether married or not. Right. How are you doing? You all right? Huh? Just out there. Warm, isn't it? You warm out there as well? Or is it just me? Warm, isn't it? How much can you stomach? Should we do a two-part series? How much have I got? There's hope, folks. There's hope. I'm not talking about society. I'm talking about the church. How did you become a part of the church? I'm not talking about North Baddeley Baptist Church. I'm talking about the church. The church of Jesus Christ. How did you enter in? Did you enter in as the husband of, the wife of, the son of, the daughter of, the father of, the mother of? No. It was you, wasn't it? Christ called you by name. And you answered him. And so now in the church as an individual, that's your status, isn't it? Right? As a child of God. Now, you're in the church. Can you improve or enhance that status by marrying so-and-so, the son of the pastor or whatever? Can you marry into the right clique or group? Can you, by having certain children who make great accomplishments, can you enhance your status in the church by all these means? You go up the ecclesiological ladder by all these means. I mean, sadly, truthfully, humanly speaking, that's how a lot of judgments are made, isn't it? But it's not the truth. The only way we can enhance our status, for want of a better word, in the life of the church, is by our own personal, individual, unique devotion to Christ and godliness. That is the most important thing, isn't it? That's the only thing. God looks on the heart. On the heart. Our perseverance, our faithfulness to God. That's it. It's so important to remember, isn't it? That thing of singleness. And that abides whether we're married or not. And I think single people are more exposed to this, perhaps more conscious and aware of this, and they see sometimes, in especially amongst marriage, how there is a temptation, please do pray for us, the temptation to hide behind our husband, or hide behind our wife, or hide behind our children, or hide behind our parents. And not just stand before Christ. We need prayer, don't we? So I'm just saying singularity is very, very important, and theologically very, very important issue. We need to keep our eyes on Jesus. Would you enter? Tell me, would you enter? If I told you that if you get married, it will take you away from the Lord, would you do it? How important is it? You've got to see his place in it all. If I said that marriage would enhance your relationship with Christ, would you do it? You know, that's the benchmark, isn't it? The benchmark is about your relationship with Christ. Now, people have kind of think Paul's a bit against marriage, don't they? I think he's a bit against marriage because he sees the importance of singleness, the real importance of singleness. But I think what he's against is the idolatry of marriage. You can idolize marriage and become something it was never intended to be. And just like these men were also downgrading marriage, I'm not saying it needs to be downgraded, but it has to be kept in its proper place. And it's only when you've got hold of that that you can enter into a proper, well-adjusted Christian union, right? So let's come through to the end of this. Verse 36 to 40, quickly. Marriage is obviously not the be-all and the end-all. And there is one point here in verse 39 where he actually makes a very categorical statement. Up until now, I'm giving you some advice, some fatherly advice, some trustworthy advice. I'm not telling you what to do. It's not a sin, da 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 da. And then he says, there's something you must do. You must do. In verse 39, he's talking to widows here, people who've been married, and they're now free to remarry, and they're considering their options and so on and so forth. He says, basically, you know, you're free, except there's one thing, he says, and he puts it in the strongest possible terms. He must be the Lord's. And that's really substantiating what we're saying before, isn't it? Because godliness is the most important qualification for marriage, isn't it? It's not how much money has he got. It's not how much money we've got, guys. It's not our degrees. All your degrees. Okay? It's not that. It's not our education. It's not your George Clooney looks, Ron. Okay? I know you've rested on it for a long time. It's not your brilliance. It's not your genius. Or your skills, or your attributes, or your sense of humour. It's important, isn't it? Sense of humour. But it's not the most important thing. Christ in you. This is a great leveller, isn't it? A great leveller. Because you can't buy it. Do you remember Simon Magus tried to buy the Holy Spirit? You can't buy it. You can't go to college and study it and get it. It's just you and the Lord. You and the Lord. And that is the most attractive thing about a Christian person. It's your personal relationship with Christ. And if that you're going to enter into a relationship or a friendship or an association or a church group or whatever it is, but it's not got a sense of him about it, why would you want to do that? Is the money really that important? You'll lose it. Is his good looks really that important? They'll fade. Christ. So there's hope. There's hope for us, isn't there? There's hope. If we will take advantage of Christ's offer to come to him. To come to him in prayer. To seek his face. To be the men, the women, the young people, the children he's calling us to be. Nothing more to say, is there, right now? I'm sure there's lots of questions left open from that passage. Feel free to buttonhole me on the door. But I'll leave these things to your thoughts. Okay? We've got something further to sing, haven't we? And we'll pray at the end.